Chapter 7, Learning-Centered Assessment, Waldorf Methods in Context. Many education scholars are currently exploring and promoting alternative student assessments. That is, assessments instead of or in addition to the standardized testing prevalent in public education. We propose that this field of inquiry is an appropriate and useful context for better understanding the Waldorf approach to student assessment. In the work of a few education scholars at the forefront of this field, we find touchstones for useful comparison with Waldorf methods of teaching and assessment. Our purpose here is to position the Waldorf methods that we documented and that we believe are representative of Waldorf teaching generally into relationship with these touchstones. We begin with two premises, both of which are well supported in the literature. The first is that alternative methods of student assessment need to replace or at least accompany widespread high-stakes standardized testing if the goal is better student learning outcomes. Extensive literature on alternative assessment in the profession, some of which we cite in Chapter 1, testifies that many non-Waldorf educators accept this premise. The second is that classroom assessment, curriculum-embedded assessment carried out by teachers based on classroom instruction, is the most promising alternative to standardized tests for improving educational outcomes. Many education scholars have worked and continue to work on the basis of this premise, holding the view that the fairest and most reliable assessments are classroom assessments that are ongoing and based on various indicators. For example, Erasian, 2005, Barron and Darling Hammond, 2008, pages 63 to 70, Stiggins, 2001, Wiggins, 1998. While sharing these two premises, we reiterate one important way in which Waldorf educators differ from their non-Waldorf colleagues in regard to alternative assessments. Some scholarly proponents of classroom assessments think that standardized testing, while not entirely reliable or fair, still has a useful supplementary role in determining what students have learned. Waldorf class teachers at the elementary level generally do not agree. They rarely supplement their own assessments, which include, in the higher grades, their own teacher-made tests with external testing or tests in subject textbooks. What is the purpose of student assessment? Calls for radical reimagining of the purpose of assessment, assessment for rather than of learning, are especially resonant with the Waldorf approach. Black and others, 2004, Shepherd, 2000, Stiggins, 2002, William, Lee, Harrison, and Black, 2004. Assessment for learning is any assessment for which the first priority in its design and practice is to serve the purpose of promoting students' learning. It thus differs from assessment designed primarily to serve the purposes of accountability or of ranking or of certifying competence. An assessment activity can help learning if it provides information that teachers and their students can use as feedback in assessing themselves and one another and in modifying the teaching and learning activities in which they are engaged. Black and others, 2004, page 10. In the assessment for learning approach, accountability, along with ranking, rewards, penalties, and other consequences, is not one of the uses of assessment. Assessment for learning, also called educative assessment, is assessment that tells students what they know or need to know. It is learning-centered rather than simply for audit. Wiggins, 1998. That the only legitimate purpose of student assessment is to activate further student learning is fundamental to Waldorf pedagogy. Mitchell and others, 2008. As we showed in Chapter 5, assessment for learning was a given in the classrooms of the case studies. An understanding on the part of those teachers of the pedagogical purpose of assessment that governed and guided the design and the carrying out of lessons. The social constructivist conceptual framework proposed by Shepherd, 2000, for supporting more learning-centered assessment compares well with the Waldorf understanding of the classroom as a social community. Shepherd's is an emergent paradigm in which teachers' close assessment of students' understandings, feedback from peers, and student self-assessments would be a central part of the social processes that mediate the development of intellectual abilities, construction of knowledge, and formation of students' identities, 2000, page 4. This framework contrasts with the increasingly powerful conception of assessment and instruction as two separate activities with two different purposes, a conception with increasing influence on public policy. Similarly, Gallagher and Goodman, 2008, propose a critical constructivist model of the classroom as a culture of mutual enhancement, a social environment for learning and for engaging students in shared responsibilities. As we say elsewhere, according to Waldorf pedagogy, the effectiveness of teaching in the elementary years depends on the building over time of a relationship of mutual trust and respect between teachers and students. In short, assessment for learning means creating a learning culture where students and teachers would have a shared experience that finding out what makes sense and what doesn't is a joint and worthwhile project, essential to taking the next step in learning. Shepherd, 2000, page 8. What is needed are challenging tasks to elicit higher order thinking, emphasis on process as well as outcome, and assessment integrated with instruction, with expectations that are visible to students and students active in evaluating their own work. Page 8. These recommendations correspond closely with the approach to teaching and assessment that we documented in Waldorf classrooms. In accord with these scholars, the Waldorf teachers we followed construed the purpose of all assessment as pedagogical or educative, rather than for assigning grades and ranking students, to enhance immediate learning and motivate and inspire further learning. Both the process and the products of assessment were meant to be learning opportunities, especially in the realm of self-knowledge. They would agree with Wiggins, 1998, that this is a moral purpose. Its aim must be to provide the help that students deserve. Pages 1 to 18. The teacher's methods. How should teachers begin? Understanding by design. The teacher's methods for planning instruction that we documented in the case studies were comparable to the approach called backward design, Wiggins, 1998, or understanding by design, Darling Hammond and others, 2008, Wiggins and McTighe, 2005. In this approach, a teacher's plans for assessment determine the planning of instruction. Teachers must ask themselves at the outset, what would be evidence of students having attained the understanding, skills, and knowledge important for the subject at this level? In other words, what are the desired results, and how will I know students have achieved them? Instructional plan and learning activities are then based on these considerations. To elaborate, the teacher's task is to 1. Establish what it is that students should know, understand, and be able to do. 2. Specify the evidence by which he will know the results have been attained. 3. Specify the knowledge and skills that will enable students to achieve these results. 4. Design a sequence of activities and experiences to enable the development of understanding and skills that will engage students by responding to their needs, interests, and abilities. And 5. Specify what to teach and what materials are needed. Wiggins, 1998, pages 206 to 209. Also Wiggins and McTighe, 2005, pages 177 to 184. These steps correspond closely to the answers given when we asked our participating teachers, what are the goals of the block? What are your plans for helping students achieve them? What resources did you use for planning? How did you carry out instruction? And how did you know to what extent students met goals? The journal questions shaped their answers, of course, but we had to ask these questions because we knew that our teachers were in control of the process and not bound by scripted curricula or textbooks. The journal format was set before we became familiar with the literature on backward design and understanding by design. The correspondence is not fortuitous. It is a result of the fact that these scholars are addressing teachers who, like Waldorf teachers, are, or should, be working independently of prescribed curricula, scripted or textbook-dictated lessons, or externally imposed testing, and are therefore free to use backward design. In our experience, backward design is inherent in Waldorf pedagogy, wherein teachers likewise are not subject to these constraints. Waldorf teachers are expected to implement the rich curriculum of worthy content using their own creativity, training, experience, and collegial support. Our participating teachers' journals reported, with each new block, their planning of activities and assignments always in relation to block goals. There was no instance of an assignment, recitation, field trip, memorized poem, written work, homework, or project that was not justified by its role in forwarding the learning goals of the block. To recall one example, when Beverly was planning her 7th grade physiology block, the desired outcome was that her students understand how the human body works, including functions of the systems. She asked herself, what experiences could she arrange to facilitate this, and what would enable her to judge how much they were grasping as the block progressed? She planned and carried out the instruction we reported in Chapter 5. an exercise in pulse taking, dramatizations, drawings and diagrams, the keeping of food journals, and other assignments. Proponents of backward design are emphatic that the broad goal in any instructional unit must be that students attain and demonstrate real understanding of a subject. And if a teacher is to assess understanding, she must know what is meant by understanding. Understanding means more than knowing facts or exercising certain skills. A student who understands can make conceptual links, can use her knowledge in different contexts, including authentic situations, and will know the background of theory or principles. Wiggins and McTighe, 2005, pages 24 to 25. She can explain, interpret, apply, have perspective and critical distance, and can empathize, pages 44 to 62. For the development of empathy, students need experience in real situations. They can't develop empathy by reading textbooks, page 57. In almost every block, the teachers in our study stated that understanding was a goal and planned for engaging students in real-life situation. Whether students achieved understanding was not our task to determine. The point here is that their planning was clearly aimed for students to achieve something more than reciting facts or demonstrating skills. For example, to help students achieve the goal of understanding the difference between barter and money-based systems of economics, Clara had her sixth graders imagine specific scenarios where people were engaged in these systems and set up an actual time bank system at the school. Carl stated as a goal in ancient history that his fifth graders attain a basic understanding of the difference between ancient Indian and ancient Egyptian cultures. One piece of evidence he wanted was for them to write essays comparing the attitudes of these peoples toward life and death. Lynn's goal for her third grade farming block was that students understand how their food travels from farm to plate. She planned several activities around this goal, including visits to two farms and working in the school garden. Teaching seventh grade history, Bill aimed for students to achieve broad understanding of the interweaving of different strands of human effort in cooperation in science, geography, and technology that made possible the long range of voyages in uncharted waters. His instructional plans included narrations of important biographies, lessons on scientific advances, discussions of the qualities needed for effective leadership, experience with using and drawing a quadrant, map making, and shipbuilding. What is to be understood? Rich curriculum and worthy content. According to these scholars, as part of planning for understanding, the teacher should examine the worth of the topic and where it sits in relation to the area of knowledge of which it is part. She should plan instruction around the core concepts and overarching questions that go to the heart of the subject, may have more than one answer, entail analysis, synthesis, and evaluation, provoke students' interest and link to other questions. Darling Hammond and others, 2008, pages 116 to 200, Wiggins, 1998, pages 209 to 216, Wiggins and McTighe, 2005, pages 26 to 37. We documented many instances of our participating teachers planning instruction around the big question in a topical area. For example, Clara's sixth grade geology block began with her asking, how did the Earth begin? Beverly began the seventh grade astronomy block by looking at how ancient peoples made sense of the heavens. Bill expected his seventh graders to know the background of significant discoveries or innovations with an impact on exploration. Clara began the economics block by asking, if you were completely isolated, how would you manage to meet your needs? Laura planned third grade measurement activities to enable students to understand first and foremost what a unit is. Bill raised this thought-provoking moral issue in the seventh grade history block. The same men whose courage, skills, and resolve accomplished great advances in exploring new continents, also laid the foundations for the slave trade. A related principle in teaching for understanding is to connect with students' previous knowledge and attend to step-by-step scaffolding of the learning process. Darling Hammond and others, 2008, page 5. The logic of a design should be the logic of learning, not some abstract order of presentation of topics to be learned. Wiggins, 1998, pages 205 and 206. In many of their journals, our teachers wrote of their concern to follow the understanding curve of their students. That is, they reflected on what would be or should be first understood about a topic and what could be built on this initial understanding. Recapitulation and review of math skills were part of daily morning preparation. Recall and consolation of previously learned content and skills are part of the three-part teaching system that is basic Waldorf teaching strategy. See Chapter 2. Wiggins, 1998, recommends a spiral curriculum building on increasingly complex tasks, pages 229 to 230. Wiginson-McTighe, 2005, urged teachers to provide an engaging and coherent unfolding of topics that makes sense to them with not too much information up front and that involves reiterations and rethinking of key ideas and skills, page 156. Teachers need to present a subject as a narrative, including how did it begin, where is it going, why is it important. Stories are effective for raising interest, pages 134 to 153. We noted in the previous two chapters how often Waldorf teachers began with stories, reviewed basic principles, or provided a sense-experiential introduction to a subject. The fourth grade teachers began the geography block with exercises in spatial orientation in the classroom, extending to activities in their immediate surroundings, the school, and then beyond to their local communities. In chemistry class, Bill asked his students to role-play at being alchemists. Clara engaged her students in an extended, over several days, discussion of how people managed to meet their needs in the beginning, before technology and transportation. Whatever the subject, 3 to 4 week blocks allowed teachers to go into subjects in depth. A block on the same subject later in the year would build on the previous one. The Waldorf curriculum qualifies as a spiral curriculum because subjects of study recur every year with steady increases in complexity, always building and expanding on what went before. Staying with the class throughout the elementary years, the class teacher is well equipped to maintain the continuity of learning through those years. The geography curriculum is a good example. We describe here the ideal sequence set forth in the standard Waldorf curriculum. Waldorf class teachers use it as a guide. How they carry it through may vary with the individual teacher. The broad goal in geography, in first and second grade, is to awaken children's wonder toward nature and to exercise their powers of observation. Teachers will plan activities aimed at evoking wonder as a disposition and requiring those simple observational skills that are prerequisites for later inquiry in this field. In third grade, geography students learn first about their immediate surroundings, that is, the flora, fauna, and geology of their local communities. They do house building of simple structures, which is one of the earliest and most basic human adaptations to the natural environment. In third and fourth grades, they learn basic skills essential to the geographer: measurement, map making, and scaled drawings. As the grades progress, students study the geography of the United States, the Western Hemisphere, Africa, Europe, and the rest of the world with increasingly complex hand-drawn maps and knowledge of the concepts requisite for the in-depth studies in mineralogy, climatology, meteorology, plate tectonics, and other geographical subspecialties that are part of the Waldorf High School curriculum. Performance-based assessment for understanding. How does a teacher assess understanding? How will he know understanding has taken place? Wiggins, 1998, discusses the designing of educative or performance-based assessments that will provide teachers with evidence for understanding. Understanding, he says, has five aspects. Someone understands who can provide sophisticated explanation and interpretation, can use knowledge and skills in new contexts, has perspective and can take critical distance, has empathy, and has self-knowledge. All of these involve being able to rethink, reflect, and perhaps revise, pages 84 to 99. Also, Wiginson-McTighe, 2005, pages 44 to 62. A teacher must plan instruction with assessment for understanding in mind. One strategy is to design assessments that entail interacting with the students. Another is to plan recurring tasks, including tasks that will evoke misunderstanding and that require student self-assessment. She should design lessons around recurring essential questions to the field of knowledge being taught and make sure their students see the big picture. She should ensure that students understand not only the skills and knowledge they are about to learn, but also the purpose of those skills and that knowledge. She should assess students for self-knowledge through verbal recall, writing projects, or some other method. When they are well designed as authentic tasks, performance-based assignments are educative in the best sense. Wiggins, 1998, pages 319 to 326. Wiggins and McTighe, 2008, pages 5 and 6. Wiggins, 1998, argues that such assessments are in fact the best preparation for standardized tests, because standardized tests, if well designed, are proxies for more authentic classroom assessments. In themselves, however, tests can never be educative, for they provide no feedback to the students, pages 319 to 326. Performance assessments are authentic if they involve tasks with application to the real world and if they provide feedback and opportunities for self-correction. Wiggins, 1998, pages 11 and 12. To be authentic, a task or project must be realistic, require judgment, and require students to do something, and it must replicate real-life contexts. It must enable teachers to assess students' skill and knowledge in negotiating a complex task. It must allow opportunities to practice, consult resources, get feedback, and refine performance and product, that is, to self-correct, pages 22 to 24. As reported in the case studies, those Waldorf teachers had students engage in many real-life learning experiences and carry out many performance tasks that met these criteria for authenticity. In particular, the Waldorf approach to teaching science is based mainly on authentic tasks. In Waldorf teacher training, prospective teachers are taught to arrange experiments and projects in such a way that the students draw conclusions on their own, not from a textbook. Most Waldorf class teachers attend workshops on how to teach science through the grades from this phenomenological approach. The aim is to teach students to think like scientists. Assessment of student work for understanding needs to be based on the many pieces of evidence. Among the most useful is what Wiggins, 1998, calls an anthology, a compilation of evidence of tasks performed, page 194. Like an anthology, the Waldorf student's main lesson book should offer such evidence, including written assignments, quizzes, tests, drawings, write-ups of experiments, journals, charts, worksheets, illustrations, essays, final copies of dictations with spelling, punctuation, and other errors corrected. The students in the case studies did this in their main lesson books. Rubrics and criteria. Education scholars make strong recommendations for the use of rubrics in making assessments. For example, Moskal 2003, Wiggins 2008. According to Wiggins, rubrics are important for telling both students and the teacher what matters in the case of a particular assignment or set of assignments. A rubric should state the criteria for judgment, explain the expected range in quality, set forth the basis for valid, reliable, and fair scoring, and describe what distinguishes different levels of quality, pages 153 to 185. Wiggins and McTighe, 2005, provide a rubric that would enable a teacher to assess very precisely the understanding they attained. They list the six facets of understanding: explanation, interpretation, application, perspective, empathy, and self-knowledge. For each of the six, they suggest five adjectives that can describe the level of that facet. For example, under explanation, a student's attainment could be assessed as sophisticated, in-depth, developed, intuitive, or naive, pages 76 to 77. In the Waldorf case studies, none of the teachers used the term rubric in their journals, nor had we provided this concept, but a rubric, in Wiggins' description of it above, consists of criteria, and all teachers reported using criteria both for individual assignments within a block and for attainment of block goals. Both seventh grade teachers reported that they used detailed criteria for assessing students in some blocks, for example, Beverly for the astronomy project and Bill for chemistry. We discussed rubrics and criteria in follow-up interviews 2 years after gathering case study data, asking teachers to elaborate about their lists of criteria for evaluating student work. We include some of this newer information in the discussion of their tracking systems in Chapter 5. They emphasized, again, as they had in their journals, that students get detailed responses about their work on a continuous basis and are aware of teachers' expectations. The use of checklists or criteria by teachers in the case studies varied from grade to grade. One teacher told us that in the first two grades, she did not keep track of academic work. She was then more interested in and tracked group dynamics and individual social, emotional, and physical aspects of development. In third grade, she carefully tracked individual performance for meeting criteria that she set ahead of time and that the students understood. She had criteria for artistic, written, and oral work. The others elaborated on what they had told us about the various tracking systems that we describe in Chapter 5. In general, teachers would make individual decisions about the use of checklists of criteria depending on the subject and the nature of the assignment. These responses were typical of what we know through our connection with Waldorf education over many years. In the lower grades, through grade 4 or 5, Waldorf teachers usually do not assign grades and rarely use rubrics for academic subjects. They do always have in mind specific expectations for students to meet, whatever the block, but many of those expectations concern incalculable aspects of development in non-cognitive as well as cognitive abilities, such as a child's enthusiasm in group activities. By the time their class reaches sixth grade, teachers focus increasingly on academic standards with corresponding increase in the rigor of their assessments. The report format the Cheshire Waldorf School, see Chapter 6, used for sixth grade and up exemplified this rigor. In our experience, however, Waldorf elementary level teachers have not used rubrics of the complexity suggested by Wiggins and McTighe, 2005, described above, with five levels of each of six facets of understanding. Standards and expectations. Wiggins, 1998, uses the term standard to refer to a description of a specific level of exemplary performance, a worthwhile target, a statement about what students need to know and be able to do. It can be absolute or developmental, which means keyed to the level of the students. And he distinguishes three different kinds of standards. Content standards describe what students should know and be able to do. Performance standards state how well the work is to be done. Task standards are specific worthy tasks which students should be able to perform and which constitute evidence for learning, page 106. Feedback to students is meaningless unless students know and understand both the criteria for a piece of work and the standard that they need to meet. A standard would be, for example, that a student can write well. Criteria would specify and give examples of the characteristics of good writing. Expectations are different. They should be in relation to past performance. A student can surpass expectations but not meet standards. Wiggins, 1998, pages 104 to 105, pages 154 to 158. In the Waldorf lexicon, standards are the benchmarks that are set for each grade and that are understood by the teachers based on their training and experience as norms for that grade and age. They are set for the year. The standards that we looked at included the three types that Wiggins distinguishes. The goals that the teacher set for each block were possibly equivalent to what Wiggins terms as expectations. Their block goals, or expectations, identified the steps toward meeting grade standards over the course of the year. They were emphatic about their practice of continually informing students about their progress in relation to expectations. And knowing students well, they felt they were well positioned to make any adjustments in expectations for the class that would be appropriate for individuals. Hence the benefits of narrative reports, which can explain in a supportive, encouraging way whether or how a student as an individual is failing to meet the expectations for a block. An individual is failing to meet the expectations for a block or the standards for the year. It is important to make note of the challenge Waldorf teachers face in making fair and accurate evaluations of whether students meet standards in the non-cognitive domains, social, psychomotor, affective, which are paramount in the lower grades, but figure in student assessments in all grades. Some standards in non-cognitive areas lend themselves to objective assessment, such as, from the first grade standards of Cheshire Waldorf School, that students should be able to follow instructions, remain on task for a designated time, grip a writing implement correctly, eye track from left to right, and space letters and words appropriately on the page. Other non-cognitive standards, however, cannot be absolute and depend largely on the individual teacher's judgment. For example, what would be an absolute standard for enthusiastic participation in games, or ability to resolve peer conflicts with less adult support? In the latter case, the teacher must make observations over the course of the year in order to judge whether a student needs less support than before. Rich curriculum versus 21st century skills. A few internet-based education reformers are promoting curricula for the development of skills that they assert are needed today as preparation for economic success. Noting the rhetoric of these reformers, Senecal, 2010, offers a balanced critique of one of the more prominent initiatives, Partnership for 21st Century Skills, P21. She grants that while a focus on skills like critical thinking and creativity is commendable, initiatives like P21 are losing the worthy content to which students need exposure, the content on which to exercise these skills. Looking more closely at the P21 curriculum, Senecal sees that most of the suggested teaching modules involve computers or other technology. She argues that too much time spent on computer games, group text discussions, and gimmicks may come at the expense of worthwhile academic content. Moreover, genuine problem solving, critical thinking, and innovation, which are some of the skills deemed critical by P21, cannot be developed without grounding in such content. Having students watch videos or hold discussion through texting threatens the loss of critical abilities like communication in written and spoken English. A diffused curriculum of media-related activities, she thinks, means loss of time for disciplined study and for gaining perspective through reflection and genuine skills through practice. In an accompanying article, Munson and Bornfreund, 2010, express concerns about lessons with little or no relevance to core questions and ideas. They represent the view of Common Core, an organization that advocates for richer curriculum and publishes standards for language arts and math that have been adopted by many states. See http://www.commoncore.org. They compare P21's lessons in particular subjects with those of high-performing countries like New Zealand, Finland, and Canada. For example, in 12th grade geography, students in Switzerland study climates, habitats, populations, energy, earthquakes, global migrations, and the historical, political, and economic influence on regional divisions. In comparison, P21 has students inventory the ways in which geographical content is used in company logos and websites, and has them assess their effectiveness for getting someone's attention. This activity does not deepen students' understanding of the key topics and concepts of the discipline of geography. In another example, they compare P21's approach to studying Shakespeare with that of Canadian high schools. Students in Canada must be able to write lengthy essays showing the significance of certain passages in the plays they have studied, comparing them to others and showing thematic relevance. P21's students translate a dialogue from a play into a text message format. This lesson simply uses Shakespeare as a vehicle to teach something else, text messaging. Any written work could be used, and anyway, most students are texting constantly. They do not need practice. The conclusion, P21's program is not aligned to any worthwhile content. Munson and Bornfreund, 2010, page 9. Goodman, 2008, presents a rubric to help define critical thinking. The faculty widely recognized by education reformers as in need of cultivation. It clearly shows the importance of content and background, elements that Senecal fears are lacking in P21's toolkit of resources. Critical thinking cannot be evoked simply by asking students to think about a problem. In order to be able to recognize patterns, errors in reasoning, and relevant information, they must first study and learn about what others have thought about the question at hand. Goodman, 2008, pages 37 and 38. When rightly implemented, the elementary-level Waldorf curriculum should qualify as a rich curriculum in the sense of recommendations by the above scholars. It focuses on first principles in math and science, primary texts, and biographies in history and classics and literature. Educators like Senecal and Ravitch, 2010, pages 230 and 231, are urging reformers not to lose sight of the importance of a core curriculum in their search for solutions. Such a curriculum, with adjustments over time to meet changing circumstances, has been the basis for learning in Waldorf schools for decades. Computers and technology in the classroom. As we have shown, the Waldorf teachers' focus on experiential learning meant that students were engaged in many of the very activities promoted by P21. Group projects, demonstrations, portfolios, learning games, and discussions. But the contrast couldn't be greater, for media and technology were absent from the Waldorf classroom of the case studies. The absence of computers in Waldorf elementary schools today distinguishes them from almost all other independent and public schools. Waldorf educators recognize the importance of computer skills, but argue that the appropriate time for computer use is adolescence. Some Waldorf high schools include programming, digital arts, and other electronic-based activities in their curricula. The principle of age appropriateness accounts for this. Like most features of Waldorf pedagogy, the limitation on classroom technology is based on observations of the development of children that, according to Waldorf educators, anyone with discernment can make. Over the long term, children benefit more, learn more, from lively engagement in activities, a close, trusting, personal relationship with their teacher, and quiet, slow time for thinking and writing, than from sitting in front of a screen. Zsigmond Mihaly, 1996, Efland, 2002, Eisner, 2002, Wiesenbaum, 2008. The presence of the teacher is especially critical for young children. They receive human feedback, empathy, encouragement, and a bond that is created that can support the development of motivation to learn, without which learning won't take place as effectively. Studies show that negative effects, or few benefits, from this ever-increasing number of hours of computer-based instruction in public elementary school classrooms have had no impact on actual practice. Fewer and fewer schools lack computers even in the lowest grades. One study that was based on the impressions of public school teachers confirms the Waldorf position on technology. But the impact of computer usage on learning remains controversial. McDonald, 2004, Richtel, 2010, 2011, 2012. An up-to-date review of the pros and cons is beyond our scope here. Instead, we offer our interpretation of the Waldorf approach in relation to the question, are computers necessary or even useful for learning in elementary school classrooms? The Research Institute for Waldorf Education has published articles on computers, for example, Chirico, 1997, Monk and Seltzer, 2001, and Talbot, 1999. If a teacher uses computer-based modules to teach a unit in some subject, then she is not deciding what the children should learn or at what pace. The material is scripted or given, structured by someone who is anonymous. It thereby loses its connection with the person of the teacher. In using such modules, teachers lose the benefits for learning of the close personal relationship she has with the children. In Waldorf pedagogy, as we have shown, the relationship of students to their class teacher and their relationship with each other form the social matrix for learning. Computers intrude on these relationships. The possibility for children to develop capacities through imitation, for example. Empathy is lost when computers replace teachers. Computers always, to some extent, undermine independent thinking and creativity because they replace it. Moreover, screen time puts a barrier between the child and real-life experience in many cases. For example, looking at real leaves in botany class is more conducive to understanding nature's variety than looking at screen pictures, no matter how detailed they are. Touching, smelling, observing leaves gives students a multisensory experience more likely to lead to full understanding and remembering of the phenomena. In other words, time spent on computers in public and private school classrooms is replaced in Waldorf classrooms with a multisensory delivery of the rich curriculum of stories, performance learning, social activities, writing, drawing, and group projects that has been described. The learning of writing skills, both the composing of text and handwritten itself, is shortchanged or altogether precluded by computer-based learning. Indeed, cursive writing is disappearing from today's classrooms. Zazima, 2011. Waldorf teachers assign a great many compositions that students write in cursive. Requiring and assessing proficiency in cursive are deliberate emphases in the Waldorf curriculum, and by no means a throwback to the days before word processing. Writing in cursive, Waldorf teachers would say, allows for slow taking in of the content, time for thinking through ideas, and valuable practice in self-directed activity. Writing in cursive is social because handwriting must be legible to be read by someone else, and is thus expressive of our fundamental human nature as communicating beings. Moreover, some research has verified the positive impact of learning handwriting on brain development. James and Engelhardt, 2012. The new taxonomy, motivation and learning. Most educators recognize that motivation is an essential condition or starting point for learning to take place. For example, Wiggins and McTighe, 2005, pages 25 to 26, Starko, 2010, pages 248 to 282, Black and others, 2004. Motivation plays a critical role in the model for learning recently proposed by Marzano and Kendall in the New Taxonomy of Educational Objectives, 2007. Their model has revived the discussion of how best to classify and understand different kinds of educational objectives. Previously, the standard guide for stating learning objectives and defining skill levels was Bloom's taxonomy, which specified three domains of learning: cognitive, affective, and psychomotor. In the cognitive domain, Bloom, 1956, specified six cognitive processes: knowledge, informational retrieval, facts, and so forth; comprehension, application, analysis, synthesis, evaluation; In their revision of Bloom, Anderson and others, 2001, distinguished between knowledge domains with four types and the cognitive process domain with six types of thinking. Marzano and Kendall point out that both these models base their learning goals on assumed level of difficulty. This assumption fails to take into account that the degree of difficulty depends on both the inherent complexity of a given problem and the level of familiarity of the student, pages 1 to 11. It is a theory as well as a model, the authors claim, because it predicts how students will engage in and proceed with a process of learning. It has implications for curriculum design, for how to frame objectives focused on the development of higher-order learning skills, and for designing assessments. Marzano and Kendall propose three interacting systems of thinking: self-system, metacognitive system, and cognitive system. The cognitive system breaks down into four main processes: retrieval, recall, recognition, comprehension, analysis, and knowledge utilization. Each of these breaks down further and entails the execution of procedural knowledge. The starting point, however, is the decision of the individual student to engage and apply himself. This decision arises in the self system, which consists of an interrelated arrangement of attributes, beliefs, and emotions. It is the interaction of these that determines both motivation and attention, page 55. From a Waldorf perspective, because of its recognition of the importance of motivation in the learning process, this model is a welcome development. If we try to align this model with Waldorf pedagogy, however, we find two areas of disjunction. First, notwithstanding its claim to capture how students actually learn, the new taxonomy does not take into account any differences in the way children learn at different ages as they develop over time. Unlike Waldorf pedagogy, based as it is on an observation of the developmental stages of childhood, the model proposes a same-for-all-grades understanding of how children learn and relate to the world. Waldorf teaching is always concerned with motivation, but recognizes that the best method for motivating a child of 7 or 8 is not the same as the one for a student in junior high school. The model also does not consider the motivating potential of the teacher-student relationship, which is especially important in the lower grades. In Waldorf education, the teacher's relationship to the student has a major impact on motivation and thus on learning. Children who love and trust their teacher will be motivated to engage in learning activities. Peer relationships are also important increasingly as the grades progress for generating enthusiasm. Waldorf teachers guide students in activities where they do tasks together, activities whose success depends on students listening and responding to each other. The Waldorf social curriculum sets expectations for learners to cooperate, to respect others' viewpoints, and to feel sensitivity to others' needs. Healthful classroom social dynamics can have a very great effect on how much and how well students learn, Waldorf educators would say, just as unhealthy dynamics can greatly lessen students' receptivity. Kerwin Miller, Whitesmith and Calfee, 2010, Elish Piper, Matthews and Risco, 2013. Most of the suggested applications of the model would not be appropriate for younger grades in Waldorf schools. For example, the authors suggest, as an objective for self-system thinking, that the student will be able to identify how important the information, mental procedure, or psychomotor procedure is to him or her, and why. Marzano and Kendall, page 119. Likewise, the student will identify her own degree of competence, emotional response, and level of motivation, asking herself, am I ready for this topic? Do I think I need this foundation for future learning? From a Waldorf perspective, these objectives would be unreasonable for younger children. In the new taxonomy model, the student makes a conscious decision to engage in learning. A self-conscious examination of inner readiness to learn is neither necessary nor appropriate in the Waldorf understanding of how young children learn. The young child is naturally open to the world and without judgment. This is the time to encourage and cultivate wonder and reverence, which are sure grounding for later intellectual curiosity. Therefore, the natural unself-consciousness of the younger child in approximately grades 1 through 3 is a quality that needs to be encouraged while it lasts. The emphasis in Marzano and Kendall's model on self-knowledge and metacognitive thinking, however, is important in Waldorf higher grade classrooms. With the development of a healthy self-conscious sense of being a separate self, which arises naturally later, beginning around age 9, such self-directed questions will appropriately encourage motivation to learn. Student self-assessment was a prominent characteristic of the assessments we documented, beginning in fourth grade and increasing in prominence in later grades. In Waldorf high schools, students are expected to take major responsibility for evaluating their own preparation and their attainments. The new taxonomy model thus has some applicability to Waldorf methods at these higher grade levels when learning goals are mainly cognitive, and even to a degree in 7th and 8th grades with regard to subject-related knowledge and skills. A second disjunction between the new taxonomy and Waldorf pedagogy is that the applications its authors propose are all directed toward cognitive learning. Affective and psychomotor factors are incorporated into the model, but motivation and attitude, metacognitive processes, and psychomotor processes are in the service of learning goals in the cognitive domain. Content knowledge and understanding, application of knowledge, and critical thinking skills are exercised on subject content. In other words, while the model does incorporate feelings, motivation, and psychomotor skills for subjects that need them, they are subservient to the kind of learning that can be measured by conventional tests. It is a model of thinking processes, and the function of motivation in their model is to support cognitive learning. In Waldorf pedagogy, motivation serves in the development of aesthetic, affective, and social as well as cognitive goals, and the function of the teacher is to activate motivation for itself as a disposition important for lifelong learning and active lifelong engagement in the world. Waldorf teachers are almost always attending to students' attentiveness, interest, and motivation. In our experience, the encouraging of these attitudes is the heart of teaching in all grades. The strengthening of a student's disposition to learn will inevitably lead to better cognitive learning, but the awakening of a habit of curiosity and wanting to know more is itself a goal. Whereas in the new taxonomy model, motivation is important only for its role in learning that is understood to be in the cognitive domain. Comprehensive Age-Appropriate Assessment. The Waldorf Difference. Waldorf assessments of students are comprehensive, which means they take into account learning and development in all domains, cognitive, affective, psychomotor, and social. The terminology artificially separates what are interdependent, interweaving, inseparable capacities involved in learning. The terms are a convenience. We have explained that most Waldorf teachers do not use these terms. They speak instead of thinking, feeling, and willing, an assessment of the whole child in relation to the stages of development that inform the Waldorf curriculum. What is meant by age appropriateness in Waldorf education is not simply teaching subjects at a grade level. When non-Waldorf educators make recommendations, they presumably understand that teachers will set expectations and shape instruction appropriately to fit the grade being taught. In their discussion of how to assess understanding, Wiggins and McTighe, 2005, acknowledged that different ages and grades require different kinds of assessment. Rubrics of the assessment of performance tasks, they note, as well as the tasks themselves, need to be developmentally scaled, pages 86 to 88. For the most part, however, the available literature does not discuss age or grade differences. All good teachers want to activate student enthusiasm for learning, but how this is achieved will depend on the age of the students. The recognition in Waldorf pedagogy of the special importance of engaging the will forces in children up to approximately age 7 and of the strength and primacy of the faculty of imagination in children from approximately age 7 through 12 or 13 seems to be unique in today's education literature. For example, Starko, 2010, discusses creativity in the specific subject areas of language arts, social studies, and the arts, pages 173 to 205, but takes no account of the possibility that younger children learn best with a different approach. A Waldorf teacher of the early grades would not ask students, as Starko suggests, to talk about the meaning of a tale or story or to explore motivation of the characters, page 188. A critical stance toward any text as suggested by Pearson, Servietti, and Tilson, 2008, pages 71 to 111, would be inappropriate in lower grades of the Waldorf school. Teachers would argue that it is not helpful to have young children discuss ideas from a book when they haven't yet any basis for their ideas. In early grades, that is grades 1, 2, 3, and continuing to some extent in grade 4, Waldorf class teachers do not encourage analytic thinking because analysis, which aims for objectivity and is inherently distant in feeling, cuts off or undermines a child's feeling of engagement, which is the way young children understand such content. The goal is to enable children to feel deeply with reverence and gratitude for what the story reveals. Teachers involve students busily in subject-related activities, but they are concerned mostly with observing and encouraging children and not with measuring academic achievement. The Waldorf principle of age appropriateness remains a distinctive characteristic of the Waldorf approach. Imagination, the faculty with which we make images and new thoughts, is the basis for creative and independent thinking later on. The strengthening of this faculty in school activities is extremely important in a time when children receive information from all directions in our pervasive, media-saturated culture. There is a growing body of research that confirms that cultivation of the powers of imagination through play and especially through the arts enhances cognitive ability and creativity. Heflin, 2002, Hamilton, 2014. If cognitive learning is the ultimate goal, then exercise of the imaginative faculty, the making visible to the mind's eye something that is not visible to the physical eye, is critical at a time when that faculty is at its strongest. What is being accomplished in Waldorf classrooms in the early grades is considered essential groundwork for all later academic learning. Small motor activities like wax modeling and knitting are preparation for thinking. Learning to knit gives the child an experience through the activity of his will of sequence, of pattern, of the meanings of over, under, through, forward, and backward, not to mention the pride and pleasure in achievement. He will have practiced and grown in patience and the ability to follow through. Spatial awareness and hand-eye coordination through learning to knit are the foundation for learning to read. Games and exercises also build hand-eye coordination as well as spatial and temporal orientation, which are critical reading skills where the eye must translate relatively small markings, letters, into meaningful sounds. In Waldorf schools, children learn to write before they take up reading, which is taught gradually starting in the second grade. The reasons for this are often misunderstood. One reason is that writing ensures that the child is deeply engaged in his will and what he is doing. He must attend to his fingers, hand, and arm. He can see at once the results of his movements and is actively involved in creating words that he can then read and that he understands are communicative. Others can read them. He has achieved something miraculous. In other words, Waldorf teachers focus on reading skills in the earliest grades, but in a way that takes maximum advantage of the active will forces of young children. With writing, they are working with students on sequencing, hand-eye coordination, eye tracking, small and large motor skills, and sensory discrimination. All of these have been demonstrated to be prerequisites for reading. Waldorf educators do not dispute that many children are able to read in the first grade and even earlier. Early readers may play a role in helping their classmates, but they want to ensure the strongest foundation for this all-important skill. Rudolf Steiner gave the rationale for the curriculum of the early grades in lectures to teachers of the first Waldorf school. For example, Steiner, 1921 to 2003. For accounts by today's Waldorf educators, see www.ywaldorfworks.org and the catalog of Steiner books at www.steinerbooks.org. The social curriculum is also unique to Waldorf education. All schools require students to demonstrate social skills. But in Waldorf education, they are explicitly part of the curriculum and grade standards. Social skills lay the foundation for morality and for understanding the larger ethical questions that arise later in history and social studies. Participating in guided social activities can provide a foundation for the capacity of judgment in social situations, which is so important in public life as an adult. The game goes well and is more fun when you are careful to throw the beanbag so your partner can catch it. The group recitation is more effective and fun when everyone speaks clearly and confidently. Waldorf education is distinctive in its explicit concern in student learning standards and in instructional strategies for healthy affect development. Waldorf teachers recognize that the development of social skills is interwoven with that of feelings, for example, appreciation of others' contribution, and empathy with this point of view. Goleman's work, 1995, on emotional intelligence, has validated the important role of feelings in cognition. See also Baran, 2007, Kahn, 2013, Salovey and Meyer, 1989. Discussing techniques for helping students generate new ideas, Starko, 2010, reminds readers that Albert Einstein said that intuition rests on sympathetic understanding, and the effort involved comes straight from the heart, page 121. She lists 13 thinking tools to support students in connecting their feelings with content: sense observation, imaging, both recalling past sensory experience and imagining new experiences, abstraction, recognizing and forming new patterns, body thinking, awareness through the body before bringing content to the mind, playing, and others, pages 121 and 122. Her view accords with the Waldorf understanding of the importance of movement and multisensory engagement in early grades for independent creative thinking later on. The theory of multiple intelligences. Over the past 3 decades, education psychologist Howard Gardner has challenged the commonly held view of what counts as intelligence and has argued for more comprehensive methods for assessment of learning. 1993, 1995, 2004, 2008. He originally identified 7 distinct capacities or intelligences that can be developed in students apart from the usual cognitive ones: verbal linguistic, math logical, spatial, musical, body kinesthetic, interpersonal, and intrapersonal. He believes it is essential to depart from standardized testing because such tests measure only a small portion of intellectual abilities, 1993-31. As we have said, Waldorf educators concur with this view that in failing to evaluate non-cognitive abilities, standardized tests have limited value for assessing the true capabilities of students and also for predicting success outside of the school setting, Gardner, 1993-39. The Waldorf approach of educating the whole child, aesthetic and moral sensibilities, knowledge and cognitive skills, physical health, social skills, musical and artistic abilities, is comparable to Gardner's approach. And the comprehensive and age-appropriate assessment strategies typical of Waldorf teachers converge for the most part with Gardner's recommendations for a new form of assessment that needs to be intelligence fair, presented in such a way that the potency of an intelligence can be monitored directly and not through the lens of logic and mathematics. It should be developmentally appropriate, using techniques appropriate to the child's developmental level in the particular domain of knowledge at issue, 1993-72. Gardner's work has generated a considerable amount of supportive research and has also resulted in practical applications. For example, the Teacher's Guide, Developing Students' Multiple Intelligences, Nicholson and Nelson, 1998. It has also generated controversy among educators, psychologists, and others who maintain that he has misconstrued intelligence by simply expanding the definition to include non-cognitive attributes. But the current proliferation of recommendations for more comprehensive assessment would seem to validate the potential of this approach. Art and cognition. A number of scholars are exploring the relationship between art and cognitive ability. For example, Clark 2007, Davis 2007, Eflin 2002, Eisner 2002, Heilman 2005, Melnick, Whitmer, and Strickland 2011, Morris, Urbanski, and Fuller 2005, Posner and Patoin 2005. The International Journal of Education and the Arts publishes results of much research in this field. Waldorf educators, who publish mainly in the research bulletin of the Research Institute for Waldorf Education, also contribute to this literature. For example, James, 2006, Mayer, 1995. Maynard, 2008, reviews research done by the Dana Foundation, showing that in 4 to 6-year-old children, only artistic activity lights up the whole brain in fMRI measurements. See www.ijea.org and www.waldorfresearchinstitute.org. The most prominent advocate for the arts in education is Stanford's Eisner, for example, 1972, 2004, 2005. In a recent lecture available on YouTube, Eisner, ND, he explains the role of the senses in cognition, noting that the extent of refinement, that is, responsiveness, of the senses determines what can be known. Sensory refinement is the basis and necessary condition for the making of distinctions, the forming of concepts, and the creating of something new. He gives 4 reasons, among others, for engaging students in the arts. 1. They learn to be attentive to relationships, a capability that is critical to understanding anything. 2. They learn that problems can have more than one solution. 3. They experience complex problem solving, that purposes are not fixed, but change with circumstances and opportunity. The means sometimes determine the ends, but not always the reverse. 4. They experience and learn that small differences can have large effects. In short, the arts develop the mind. The importance of art in Waldorf pedagogy is not limited to its demonstrable benefits for learning in the cognitive domain. Drawing, painting, sculpting, and other artistic activities are means for expressing and cultivating the feeling life, which in Waldorf education is as important as cognition, as noted elsewhere in this study. Art is important for life, Eisner, N.D., says, in awakening feelings in every field of endeavor. In words that recall our discussion of the broad goal of education, schools should not be boot camps for learning how to make a living, but places for learning how to make a life. And schooling, he says, virtually echoing the goal setting of Waldorf teachers, needs to be more imaginative, playful, and stimulating of curiosity. In Waldorf schools, art is not only a separate subject in the curriculum. As we have shown, teachers integrate artistic activity, drawing, colored pencil illustrating, painting, border designing, into every academic subject. This was the case for all 9 teachers in every block subject, including mathematics and science. We suggest that the Waldorf Arts Imbued curriculum and the specific subject-related art assignments could serve as inspiration for mainstream educators and others who are discussing whether and how, in practical terms, to bring the arts back into the curriculum. To summarize, Waldorf methods of teaching and assessing are aligned with the recommendations of respected non-Waldorf scholars in the field of education. Waldorf educators share their public sector colleagues' concern for ensuring the very best learning outcomes. Every item on the list of conditions for effective teaching in Darling Hammond's Introduction to Powerful Learning 2008 was reported by our teachers and is a feature of Waldorf methods as we know them through our professional and personal relationship with Waldorf education. Meaningful tasks that reflect real-life situations, student engagement in experiential learning, tasks that connect with students' prior knowledge, step-by-step scaffolding of the learning process, continuous assessment, clear expectations with constant feedback, and encouragement toward self-knowledge, page 5. Fundamentally and most important, Waldorf education is aligned with those education scholars who argue that the purpose of assessment is not for accountability, but to support student learning. Can we trust the teachers? So far, we have been concerned to report how our participating teachers conducted assessments and in what ways their methods, and Waldorf methods in general as we know them, are comparable to methods urged by selected scholars. We did not evaluate the objectivity or validity of the particular assessments that our teachers reported making during the study. Can we expect that Waldorf teachers' assessments, including those documented in the case studies, are valid and reliable? The two main criteria that an assessment must meet in order to be considered a good assessment, Erasian 2005, pages 14 to 19, 38 to 41, 130 to 135. The validity of an assessment is measured by its relevance to a learning goal. For example, the observation of a student's performance in a science lab would be relevant to an assessment of his proficiency in that science. A reliable assessment is one that is stable over time. For example, an assessment that a student had not grasped certain material because he failed to participate in class discussion one day would not meet the criteria for reliability, for he may have been feeling unwell that day. To the extent that validity and reliability, as characteristics of good assessments, depend on how well teachers know their students, we may state at the very least that Waldorf class teachers are well positioned to make such assessments. They are well positioned especially for good assessments of the development of capabilities and dispositions for which a longer-term perspective is important. But the question remains, especially in regard to academic knowledge and skills. If no external testing corroborates the attainment measured by Waldorf teachers, how can we know if the teacher's assessment is valid and that the learning has or has not taken place? And in the absence of externally imposed, standardized testing of compliance with externally set standards for learning, how and to whom are Waldorf schools held accountable? How can we be sure that teachers are competent to carry through on the promises that Waldorf schools make in their mission statements? The next chapters present what Waldorf educators submit as answers to those questions.